Hi, I'm Baruch Lev, accounting and finance professor at New York University Emeritus, formerly at University of Chicago and University of California, Berkeley. In between, I was an investment banker and a partner at a consulting firm. I'm the co-author of the new book, The M&A Failure Trap, Why Most Mergers and Acquisitions Fail, and How the Few Succeed. My co-author of this book is Professor Feng Gu, who is the chair of accounting department at University at Buffalo in New York. We are going to share with you five key ideas from our book. But first, a brief introduction. Corporate acquisitions are frequently the largest investment companies make. They range from a few millions to over $100 billion. For example, Dow Chemicals acquired DuPont in 2015 for $130 billion. There are close to 2,000 corporate acquisitions annually in the United States and around 6,000 worldwide for a total deal value of $3 to $4 trillion. Acquisitions affect practically everyone: corporate executives and employees, the acquired company's employees, investors, fund managers, and in many cases, the competitive environment. Airline mergers, for example, usually raise fares. Namely, corporate acquisitions affect you. Alas, our meticulous, fact-based research using 40,000 acquisitions shows the astounding result that 70 to 75% of all acquisitions fail to achieve their objectives. In fact, acquisitions are the largest destroyer of corporate value, of investors' wealth, and people's careers. How can this be, and how can this be avoided? That's what we tell you in our new book, The M&A Failure Trap. Following are the five major ideas in the book. Big idea number one: acquisitions should be the last resort. Corporate acquisitions, where an acquired company is integrated into the buyer company, closely resemble organ, like liver, transplants in humans. The target or acquired entity has to be carefully chosen, like donors, to match recipients in transplants. The buyer-target integration is difficult and time-consuming. Transplant operations are generally long, and the merger often fails. The body rejects the transplanted organ despite massive medical efforts. For that reason, doctors turn to organ transplantation as a last resort only when everything else fails, like medications or surgeries, will they try the high-risk transplant. And that's exactly should be the case for M&As. And this is our book. First big idea: corporate acquisitions should be the last resort. But as we show in our book, that's not the case in the business world. When companies hit a snag, the competitive situation worsens, sales are down, earnings turn to losses, or patents are soon to expire, big contracts aren't renewed, the first thing that comes to managers' mind is making a big transformative acquisition. Egged on by a chorus of commission-hungry investment bankers and consultants and nagging activist investors, executives go straight to the organ transplant, to acquisition. The catastrophic case of Teva Pharmaceutical, which we analyze in Chapter 1 of our book, is a classical case of urge to merge. The results of these acquisitions are often disappointing. In their haste, buyer executives often choose an inappropriate target, overpay for it, and conduct a superficial due diligence. A 70-75% acquisition failure rate is a consequence. In the book, we elaborate on very effective alternatives to acquisitions, like internal development of the required capabilities, patents, brands, etc., or using partnerships and joint ventures. All such alternatives to acquisitions should be carefully considered and some tried. As we said, corporate acquisitions should be the last resort.
Key idea number two, conglomerate acquisitions are still a lousy investment. Conglomerate acquisitions, where the target operates in an industry unrelated to the buyers, like Amazon acquiring Whole Foods and Twitch, or Intel, the semiconductor company acquiring Mobileye, the autonomous driving company, constitute now about 40% of all acquisitions. Conglomerates of yore, like LTV and Gulf and Western, each operating businesses in 10 to 15 unrelated industries, were in the 1960s and 1970s, the toast of town. Some even predicted that 6 to 7 conglomerates will one day control the entire U.S. economy. This, of course, did not happen. Rather, all conglomerates fell by the wayside in the 1980s and 1990s, causing untold losses to investors and misery to employees. Even the largest and the longest survivor of them all, General Electric, is now a dim shadow of itself. Business lesson learned? We thought so, until we saw the statistics. The dinosaurs are back. In the past 10 to 15 years, conglomerate acquisitions, particularly by cash-rich high-tech firms, were up, reaching close to 40% of all acquisitions currently. What's wrong with conglomerate acquisitions? They just don't make any economic sense. If you, as an Amazon shareholder, would like to benefit from investment in green supermarkets and also get the risk diversification that comes with investing in stocks of companies operating in unrelated businesses, just add shares of Whole Foods to your Amazon investment. Why should Amazon do it for you by acquiring Whole Foods and paying the process 35 to 40% premium to Whole Foods shareholders at your expense? Simply silly. We know. And yet many companies do it. Worse yet, because buyer and target operate in different businesses, there are no synergies to these mergers. How did Whole Foods improve the extensive cloud activities of Amazon? By feeding Amazon employees with fresh, pesticide-free apples? And indeed, many of these conglomerate acquisitions struggle. Amazon tries desperately for 10 years now to revive Twitch, and Intel intends to sell Mobileye. Why presumably smart people like buyers executives continue doing conglomerate acquisitions? The answer may lie in self-serving motives of some CEOs, on which we elaborate in Chapter 5 of our book. But most CEOs are genuinely motivated to improve their company's operations and advance the interests of their shareholders. To them, we say the second key idea is to stay away from conglomerate acquisitions.
Big idea number three, avoid the wisdom of the crowds. The voluminous literature on M&As, consultants' advice, how to do books, and academic research in economics, law, and finance frequently identifies best time to buy businesses. For example, acquire when capital markets are hot, using your high-priced stocks and when investors are euphoric about the prospects of the economy. Or acquire when all your industry peers are buying, like AI startups currently, so that you won't be left as a target or as the only one holding out. Acquire in recessions, since target prices are low. Or buy in your first year as a CEO, when your record is still untainted and people expect from you bold moves. A bewildering choice of opportunities that many follows. Merger waves are indeed highly correlated with stock prices, indicating that many CEOs follow the dictum, acquire in hot markets. Similarly, evidence shows that lots of CEOs acquire businesses in their first 2 years of tenure. So following the crowd indeed characterizes M&A, but that's not a big idea. The crucial question is how successful were the acquisitions made in those alleged opportune times? Our rich sample of 40,000 acquisitions allows us to rigorously test this question. We can, for example, compare the success of acquisitions made at peaks of stock market those made during normal market periods, or the success of acquisitions made during the first year of a CEO tenure to acquisitions made in later years. And that we did surprisingly finding that following the wisdom of the crowds in acquisitions is a loser, namely acquisitions made during the presumed opportune times, were substantially inferior in growing companies or increasing market share to those made in normal times. The reason is that acquisitions should be made when internal circumstances call for it, rather than when others are making it. Also, acquisitions made under duress. Hot market periods are short, as are recessions in the United States, often lead to picking a misfit target, overpaying for it, and conducting superficial due diligence, all recipes for failure. So our third big idea is in acquisitions, avoid the wisdom of the crowds. Follow your own strategy.
Key idea number four, set the acquisition incentives right. A recent research study on acquisition bonuses mentions Exxon, HealthSouth, Bankers Trust, and Travelers Group, among many others, as paying their CEOs $5 to $14 million bonuses for the successful completion of M&A deals. This seems to us like Wimbledon changing its player rewards policy by awarding big money prizes for just playing in the tournament rather than for winning. Sounds insane, but that's exactly how acquisition bonuses are being paid in corporate America. The bonus is awarded for completing a deal rather than for conducting a successful acquisition. Given a failure rate of 70 to 75%, the difference between completing and succeeding in acquisition is very substantial, in fact, huge. But CEO bonuses are only the tip of the compensation iceberg, since as most research has shown, company size is the major determinant of executives' compensation. Large companies are more difficult to manage, require better talent, etc., goes the argument. An acquisition, particularly a large one, will increase managers' annual compensation year in and year out, in addition to the one-time bonus. Furthermore, and most surprisingly, our analysis in Chapter 14 shows that multiple acquisitions enhance CEO tenure by 4 to 5 years. Apparently, directors are impressed by gung-ho managers who seem to try their best to improve company performance by conducting multiple acquisitions and allow them sufficient time at the helm to see these acquisitions through. The upshot, CEOs are richly compensated for conducting acquisitions rather than succeeding in this difficult activity. As we show in Chapter 14, the penalty for acquisition failure is often a slap on the wrist. This means that corporate incentives are wrongly skewed toward conducting multiple acquisitions rather than succeeding in this endeavor. To remedy this serious deficiency, which leads to an untold number of failed acquisitions, the emphasis in executives' acquisition incentives should be sharply moved from making the deal to succeeding in it. Acquisition bonuses and compensation increases should be delayed for 3 to 4 years until the consequences of the deal are clear. Furthermore, the penalties for botched acquisitions should be enhanced. Short of this, there will be no meaningful change in the devastating 70 to 75% acquisition failure rate.
Big idea number five, avoid holding on to losers for too long. Amazon tries for almost 10 years now to make its acquisition of Twitch work financially. What are the chances it will succeed in years 10, 11, 12? Very slim in our opinion, but Amazon will apparently keep trying. People in general are loath to admit to failure in securities investment as well as in corporate acquisitions. They will therefore try to hold on to losers far too long in the dim hope that circumstances will improve. More often, however, the situation becomes worse. The evidence that people hold on to losing securities investment is abundant in finance research. The evidence that executives are holding to failed acquisition for too long is provided in Chapter 11 of our book. Keeping failed acquisitions for too long has dire consequences. It wastes employees and executive time, and it diminishes the sales value of the failed target, often to zero. Why are executives holding on to failed acquisition for too long? Two reasons. First, the sunk costs, or the water under the bridge fallacy. Decision makers are wrongly affected by past investments, like acquiring a company, saying to themselves, "We invested so much in this project, let's try a bit more to make it work." But past investments are sunk costs, totally irrelevant to the forward-looking decisions about the likelihood of reviving the target with additional effort and money. Only future costs and benefits are relevant to this decision. But executives often intermingle past or sunk costs with future costs. Second reason for holding on to acquisition for too long is when you sell or terminate a failed acquisition, there is usually a substantial loss relative to the purchase price or book value. This loss, called by accountants acquisition or goodwill impairment, has to be publicly reported in the company's income statement and will cause a sharp drop in the company's stock price and embarrassing questions to executives about the wisdom of the acquisition. Better, many managers believe, postpone the day of reckoning and hold on to the failed acquisition despite the associated costs. The way out of this mess is to determine at acquisition a maximum period for the target's full integration, say a year or 18 months, depending on circumstances. If at the end of this period the target isn't integrated successfully, a new integration team unassociated with the acquisition should be assigned to decide whether to sell, terminate the target, or continue the rescue effort for a while. Being unassociated with the acquisition, this new team will be unencumbered by the sunk cost and loss reporting inhibitions of its predecessors. This is our fifth key ideas. These are indeed five big ideas for improving acquisition success. But our book provides more, many more ideas and recommendations, including a user-friendly prediction model to assess acquisition success likelihood. Thank you for listening. We hope you will enjoy reading our book, The M&A Failure Trap.